DW, Living Planet, with Jordan Wilden.
As someone who's a self-confessed non-runner and someone who doesn't really like running, every day to get myself up in the morning at 4:30 to keep going when my whole body is aching, the only thing I think about is the next generation and what kind of world I want to leave for them.
Welcome to DW's Living Planet. I'm Jordan Wilden. This week on the show, we'll be meeting the woman who ran 100 marathons in 100 days to raise awareness of the scarcity and waste of our most valuable resource, water. But first, we'll be following some feathered marathon experts. Birds migrate long distances twice a year, but their journeys are getting tougher, and sometimes they end up in unexpected places. Our journey begins in Berlin, where nightingales returning from Africa have found a spot to rest for summer in the city.
At the end of a beautiful April evening, a small group of people are wandering through Berlin's Tiergarten Park in search for some music. They don't have to venture far to find what they're looking for. Male nightingales have recently returned from Africa and are singing at full pitch.
They have an average repertoire of about 180 patterns, and a nightingale can answer with exactly the same song its rival just presented.
That was ornithologist Kim Ortega describing the sing-off between two males trying to attract female attention. She leads the night excursion organized by the Natural History Museum to listen to them. Seven people joined the tour, some to see the birds close up, others just to hear their love songs.
The singing is really beautiful. I also listen to birds around my home, but the best you can listen to there is a blackbird. This beats the blackbird. It's so nice.
Das toppt eine Amsel ja um vieles. Das ist schon toll.
You don't usually get the chance, or at least you don't go out on your own at night.
Doing this with an expert who can explain so much about the nightingale is exciting and a rare opportunity.
But in Berlin, it's not as rare as in other cities. Ornithologist Silke Vogt-Heuke describes the German capital as the capital of nightingales.
We have lots of green spaces, parks, wild areas that are not overly managed. So you still have quite a lot of nature in the green areas. And we're interested to find out whether the nightingale is actually showing a preference for exactly this rare wild nature in a city.
So does that mean nightingales like messy places?
I think it depends how you define messy, really. You can find true beauty in a park that looks like a natural forest because you find a far higher biodiversity, much more wildlife, much more wild flowers.
About 3,000 nightingales migrate to Berlin every year. And according to the city's nature conservation authorities, the numbers are constantly rising. But researchers still have reason to be cautious. Silke Vogt-Heuke again.
So we don't have such a massive decline as we have in the UK, where really 90% of the nightingale population decreased over the last 60 years. I don't think that there is any region in Europe where we have such a massive decline. But on a regional scale, nightingales for sure face population loss or maybe even extinction.
Intensive farming and pesticide use are among the factors blamed for destroying bird habitats and killing their sources of food. That's why, for example, in northern Bavaria, a lot of breeding grounds were destroyed over the last years. In order to pass on knowledge and re-engage citizens with nature, researchers at the Natural History Museum want to encourage people throughout Germany to use the free app called Naturblick, which is like Shazam for birdsong. Back in the Tiergarten Park, Kim Ortega explains how the app works. An algorithm detects whether the uploaded sounds are really nightingales, and if so, the location shows up on an interactive map. The researchers will use the data they analyze to draw conclusions on breeding behavior and different regional dialects, but also to establish whether the nightingales are actually challenged by the city noise. The night excursion stops close to the main road, but even with cars driving by, the nightingale's song carries a good distance.
Nachtigallen singen lauter, wenn es mehr Lärm gibt.
Nightingales sing even louder when there's more noise around them, but they need more energy to do that. There are even nightingales nesting close to the city highway, which I don't really understand.
In der Hecke, wo ich manchmal frage, wieso bist du hier?
In evolutionary terms, it makes sense, as only the fittest and loudest males will be the first to find a match. Once they've been successful, the female partner will lay 4 to 5 eggs in a cup-shaped nest. The babies hatch about 2 weeks later. Then, in August, it's back to Africa for the winter. So there's still plenty of time to listen to one of the most complex birdsong.
That report was filed by Teresa Krinninger. Berlin is not the only unlikely spot for migrating birds to stop off. In Senegal, birds make their pit stops in some of the most beautifully preserved wetlands, but sometimes in some awfully polluted ones too. Having wings doesn't always help birds escape the threat of man-made environmental problems, but in Dakar, the capital, regular visits from migratory water birds helped save wetlands. After more than 230 bird species were identified, the government couldn't ignore the importance of the site any longer, and they recently turned it into an urban nature reserve. Emmanuel Lande reports.
The Technopole is an exceptional urban wetland located in the heart of Dakar that hasn't always been cherished for its lakes, shallow waters, and seasonally flooded grasslands. The government had earmarked the land to develop a tech hub before realising nothing could safely be built there due to its marshy character. Senegal's Silicon Valley never saw the light of day, but the name stuck nonetheless. 233 species of birds have been identified at the Technopole, and thanks to them stopping here during their migration to feed and rest, the site was finally given protected status as a nature reserve in March this year. Maud Diallo is an ornithologist from the Nature Community Development Association, the NCD, in Dakar. The association's been fighting to protect this patch of 300 hectares since 2011. Binoculars in hand, he visits the site every day.
These birds that are flying overhead are young white pelicans. They're big, but they're juveniles. Unless you have a bit of bird-watching experience, you'd be forgiven for thinking they are grey pelicans, which is a smaller species. But flying there like that, yes, it has dark flanks, but it's a white pelican. That's one of their indicators.
Without the birds, the site's destiny would certainly have been sealed. Lacking an official purpose, the land stayed empty and vulnerable. Open-air rubbish piles started appearing overnight. Construction workers dump gravel in unsightly piles. Tires are shredded for their copper, their black carcasses strewn all over the place. And still, unscrupulous real estate developers had persisted in trying to build here, says Aliouba, a passionate nature lover and head of the NCD.
We are inside the Technopole. Everything you see was a water body that was filled in, most likely by a real estate promoter who said it belonged to him. Since it was filled in, there hasn't been too much advancement. It is a non-edificandi area, which means it's a zone you can't build in even if you have the paperwork. Construction is forbidden. Wetlands are not suitable for building housing or other human settlements on. Recevoir des habitations ou d'autres installations
humaines. The Technopole is one of three major stopovers in Senegal for migratory birds following the East Atlantic Flyway. During the northern winter, several thousand water birds from Europe and Asia flock here. Long-necked great cormorants, small sandpipers who pick out prey from the mud, or the great white heron with its impressive wingspan are regularly spotted by the experts. But the rest of the population remains relatively oblivious to their winged visitors and have exploited the site freely for decades, fishing, dumping rubbish. It was once even turned into a golf course. For Jeffrey Shitijetsi, project manager at BirdLife, which works with NCD, The government's move to protect the technopole couldn't have come at a better time, he says.
It's recently that the government designated the site as important bird area. But before, you know, it was going to be the Silicon Valley for Senegal. But I think, you know, the government of Senegal did a good choice to have it as a protected area that can give, you know, the ecosystem services.
The technopole serves a vital function on the outskirts of the city. The pools are natural collection points for rainwater, and during the annual seasonal downpour, the water levels climb as expected, forming lakes, perfect for water birds and protecting residents close by from flooding.
I think if the government was not designated that site as protected, I can assure you that in 2 years, there will nothing remaining. You've seen even some areas, they have encroached to the site.
With no rules or regulations enforced in the technopole until now, encroachment and damage to biodiversity had become a very real threat to migratory and water birds. To his dismay, Alouba witnessed it every day.
You see, there are people that come here to burn tires to extract copper. And when they do that, they destroy the vegetation. This is avicennia, a type of mangrove that we find in Senegal, and more particularly in the technopole.
The degradation and pollution don't stop there. Anything that can be used by the human population is taken without a second thought. Yet the birds return every year to smaller lakes, deeper shores, deforestation. But they return.
There are those that burn, those that dump construction waste, and those that bring household rubbish. There are others who extract sand, some who come for the water, so on and so on. Some people fish the fingerlings. We even have vegetable farmers who likely use products that are toxic to the environment. There are many actors that degrade the area.
His mission now is to get residents to see the lakes and mangroves as the home of migratory birds and their presence as a good thing. Water birds help reduce pests like midges and mosquitoes. They improve the quality of mud and soil by moving nutrients around when rooting around for food with their beaks. Having water birds around can also serve as an early warning system about the quality of the water or the abundance of fish, vital information for the nearby human population. Studies have shown that cultivating a vegetable plot on the embankments or fishing in the lakes can bring in between 15 and 20 euros a day per person. And it might take a little policing and enforcing of the rules to respect the environment, but Alouba is hopeful the state of the technopole can be turned around to keep the bird population coming. The black-winged stilt, for example, a species that rarely and irregularly breeds in West Africa in general, has been breeding since 2011 on the southern lake.
Now, as the site is a protected area, there are government agents who are permanently on the site to keep watch over what's going on. Thanks to the classification of the site, more action will be taken to clean up and rehabilitate the site so that it can fulfill its natural role.
After years of misuse, the technopole, thanks to its loyal bird population, is set to be just what nature intended for it all along. A true urban nature reserve, a lifesaver for migratory birds along the East Atlantic Flyway on their long journey from Europe to Southern Africa. For DW, Emmanuel Landet in Dakar.
When a bird has picked its breeding site, it's understandable that it doesn't want to be disturbed. The lesser flamingo flies off when threatened during the breeding season, leaving its eggs and chicks in the lurch. This year's mass exodus of flamingo couples from North and South Africa is unprecedented. Kamfers Dam, near Kimberley, is one of the only breeding areas in South Africa for the shimmering flocks of pink birds. But after the dam dried out earlier this year, more than 2,000 eggs were abandoned in scorching heat as the parents flew away to find food. Since then, an operation has been underway to save as many chicks as possible. Jan Agent has this report, which is presented by Natalie Muller.
That's the sound of the fluffy little flamingos abandoned by their parents. At the start of the year, thousands of flamingos flew away from Kamfers Dam in the north of South Africa, leaving their eggs behind. Animal rights activists intervened. A local mining company organised rescue planes, and several other organisations offered help. Volunteers stepped in to save the newly hatched chicks. they spoke of a heartbreaking situation.
It was a season drain, so the birds, it's too hard for them to move through water, so they die. And it makes me feel sad.
Sad situation, taking into consideration that thousands of birds are dying currently due to the fact that there's no rain.
In addition, the city had stopped pumping water into the dam because its infrastructure had been damaged. Bird lover Mike Bolhuis couldn't stand to see it. He's one of those who acted straight away.
I immediately intervened and arranged and created a team on that side in Kimberley and here in Pretoria, and about 900 chicks were gathered. They were flown out and we immediately started feeding. If the water leaves and the parents leaves, it's a double blow for them, and then they might die. Then we'll have to move them.
The chicks were flown to different places where flamingos can be fed and looked after. The challenge was the number of birds and how small and fragile they are. Flamingo chicks are only 15 centimetres tall, scarcely bigger than a banknote. Kata Ludinya from the Bird Research Centre in Cape Town describes it like this.
If you pick a little tiny chick out of a dam, you put it in a box, you drive it on a bucky, it has to fly. I think they were probably even driven down to Pretoria, then put on a plane. They obviously come here in very bad condition, so that's the reason why we lost so many in the first few hours.
In the beginning, the birds were too weak to stand on their own feet. They had to be fed every 3 hours, and even that was a struggle.
At the moment, they're getting fed a mixture of eggs, baby formula, prawns and fish, which is actually being prepared here behind me. So it's a lot of work, boiling eggs, peeling eggs, putting everything in a blender, then it gets pulled up in little syringes.
The food is then sprayed directly into their curved little beaks. Almost 2,000 chicks were rescued and taken to Cape Town and Pretoria. They will continue to be fed and cared for before being released back into the wild in the next few months. They may even return to Kimberley, where they hatched, and eventually they will sound like their parents.
Natalie Muller presented that report. You're listening to Living Planet. I'm Jordan Wildon. Next up on the show, we're looking at a different kind of journey and asking how much would you do for what you believe in. In the past on the show, we've heard from the children on school strikes around the world, people who have joined the no-fly movement, and families dramatically reducing their carbon footprint. But joining me in the studio now is a woman who has made a significant statement of her own. In February, Mina Gooley completed 100 marathons in 100 days to draw attention to the shortage and wastage of water. But this isn't the first challenge she's undertaken. In 2016, Mina ran 40 marathons through 7 deserts in 7 weeks. And in 2017, she ran the equivalent of 40 marathons in 40 days down 6 of the world's great rivers. And if that isn't enough, Mina has also founded Thirst, a non-profit organisation dedicated to educating people on how to avoid wasting water.
The first thing I actually did before I started running was to found Thirst, because my theory of change is that in order for us to solve our global water crisis, we need to change the way we consume. And the main reason for that is because water goes into everything we use, buy and consume every day. And what's scary about it is as population rises, as our demand for more stuff increases, so does our demand for water. And unfortunately, less than 1% of the water that's on Earth is available to us to use. So what I decided to do was to really focus on how we can reduce this demand for water. So I started Thirst in China. fastest growing consumer economy in the world. And we started going and educating the next generation of students. So we started in 2012. And at that time, we educated only 10,000 kids. And I thought, wow, yes, it takes one person at a time to change the world. But it's going too slow because experts predict that by 2030, there's going to be a 40% greater demand for water than the supply of water available. If we just go step by step, we're never going to be able to meet this deadline. So we scaled as quickly as we could. And in the intervening time, we've educated over 2 million kids. But the reason I started running is because I realized we had to do something even bigger to capture the attention and the imagination of global media, of people around the world.
And it absolutely has caught the attention of the world. Everyone's out here going, how? Are you okay? Do you need any help? You were getting up at 4:30 a.m. every morning to do these marathons. What was keeping you going through all of that?
Yeah, so on the 4th of November, when I started running, I started the New York City Marathon. Mm-hmm. And I confess, I stood on the starting line amidst 20,000 other people. There's like this big buzz at the start of any marathon. So anyone who's listening to this that's run a marathon will feel very familiar with that moment of nerves when you're standing on the starting line. But unlike everybody else there, all I was thinking about was I have to run a marathon today and tomorrow and the next day and the day after. As someone who's a self-confessed non-runner and someone who doesn't really like running, every day to get myself up in the morning at 4:30 to keep going when my whole body is aching, the only thing I think about is the next generation and what kind of world I want to leave for them. Mm-hmm. The most important thing is to leave a world where there's enough water for them not only to live but to achieve their dreams, because without water, there's no economy, there's no society, and most importantly, there's no life.
There must have been people you were speaking to before you were doing this saying, I'm going to do this thing. How did they react?
Yeah, I think, okay, in reality, most people thought I was completely barking mad. Mm-hmm. I think that's a term that was actually used many times. Many, you're barking mad. People called me crazy. People call me all different things. But if we only listen to what people say we can't do, we'll never discover what we can.
And then at 62 days in, something happened.
Oh, yeah.
What happened?
Everything was going great. Okay, so let's put this in perspective. Mm-hmm. So I started running in New York. We flew across the ocean, landed in London, told a bunch of amazing stories about food waste because 70% of the world's water goes into agriculture. Most of it gets thrown out. It's horrifying. And at day 62, something really bad happened. I'd been having pain up for about a week, honestly, probably a lot longer than that, but I blocked it out when I couldn't put my foot down anymore. My team carried me into the car and they said, tomorrow, if you can't walk across the room unaided, you're not going to run. You're going to go to the hospital. And I get a scan and we discover I've got a fracture in my leg, not a little fracture, an absolutely massive fracture in my leg. And the doctors told me if you keep going, you're going to permanently injure yourself. It was a terribly tough time because I really felt that my whole world had turned black, that my campaign was over, that I had let down the community of people whose stories I had been gifted to tell, and the people that we'd scheduled to meet in the days that were coming up, and if I stopped, I wouldn't be able to tell their stories. In that moment of darkness, a very amazing thing happened, which is that my phone started to buzz with messages of people who had heard about the problem, who started to offer to do miles for me. And on day 63, when I sat in my wheelchair, I watched my team go out and run a marathon for me. And on day 64, people we didn't know came and ran with my team to do miles for me. And on day 65, people from other parts of the world started to join in, and very, very quickly, we had thousands of people in over 160 cities in more than 50 countries and territories on every single continent of this globe running for water and running to support this campaign. By day 100, instead of doing 100 marathons in 100 days, we had run further than from the North Pole to the South Pole. So instead of being my ambition to run 100 marathons, this became a whole global movement for change.
And you still continued the tour after that, meeting
yes.
people?
Yeah. Yes.
What did you learn from all these different people that you met around the world?
The first one I learned from the people who participated in the campaign and people who ran was that you don't have to be anyone to be someone, that every single one of us is capable of doing great things, things beyond anything we could possibly imagine, if only we allow us to do so, and if only we don't listen to those others that constrain us, like we were talking about at the beginning. The second lesson is from the people I met on the ground, which is that the water crisis isn't someone else's problem. It's our problem too, that every single one of us is connected to the problems that we see, whether it's the water issues in the Aral Sea, whether it's the cotton fields of India. We don't think, where did my T-shirt come from? Where did my clothing, where did my food originate? It came from places where they may be suffering from water scarcity, but we don't ask those questions. We've forgotten that we're all connected on our planet. And the third thing I learned actually was every single one of us can make a difference. This is like, it's easy to think I'm just one person. What change can I do? What impact can I have? What can I do? But when it really comes down to the bottom line, every one of us can do one thing. It doesn't have to be running 100 marathons. It can be someone like Mike, who is a brewer in the US, and he's figured out how to make beer using 60% less water. Or there's a farmer in Jordan who's got 23 kids, like 23 kids, and he's figured out how to grow lemons in the middle of the desert using really water-efficient piping from a little spring that exists on his property. You know, he makes enough money that he can send his kids to school. All these people have just said, what can I do? What is the one thing that I can do to help solve this problem? And they've come up with a solution.
That's absolutely wonderful. I have one final question, and that's, you've done something in 2016, 2017, 2018. What's coming next? You seem like you've got so many big ideas and so much optimism and positivity.
Yeah.
What's in the future?
That's a really good question. Depends if my mum is listening or not. Look, the first thing I need to do is to get my leg better. But I have said right from the moment when I stood on the bank of a river in South Africa, there's a river called the Orange River, and it runs between South Africa and Namibia. But I stood on the bank of that river as the local people showed me these high water marks way up on the edge of the riverbank. And they said, that's where the river was like 6 years ago. Look at this, it's towering above me. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, this is the way of life that we have now. We cannot afford to make things the same way that our parents and our grandparents made them before us. And we cannot afford to treat water in the way that we have. We need to do things differently and smarter and better. And I stood on the bank of that river, and sometimes you just feel that your life has fundamentally shifted. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I'm going to run for as long as it takes. So what will I do this year? I'd really like to finish the 38 marathons that are still remaining. And I want to do those with the local community, with the people. The next campaign will be No Excuses, and it will be about mobilizing and joining together and celebrating the fact that we have an incredible community that has joined together to get these marathons done and joined together to make saving water famous.
Mina Gooley, thank you so much for coming to speak to me.
Pleasure.
Thank you. We have a longer version of that interview where Mina shares more of her stories from on the road on our website. You can find that and more environment news at dw.com/environment. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of Living Planet. Do you try to save water? How? I'd love to hear from you. Drop us a message at livingplanet@dw.com or tweet us at @dw_environment. Thanks to Ileana Giladucci and Jürgen Kern for their help making this show happen. And to you for listening. I have been and still am Jordan Wilden. Until next time.
You'll always be my day one. Day zero when I was no one. I'm nothing but myself. You are no one else. Thankful you're my day one. Thankful you're my.
I got lucky finding you. I won't beg the day that I came across you. Cause when you're with me, I don't feel blue. Not a day goes by that I would not redo. Everybody wants to love.
Yeah, that's right.
It's easy when you try hard enough. Yeah, that's right.